Yes Music Podcast, episode 57, Yes QI Part 1.
This is John Davison, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 57 of the Yes Music Podcast, one fan's exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine. Please remember how you can get involved with the podcast via the various ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. This week it's half-term holiday here in the part of the UK where I live. This means my children are off school and college, and I'm taking a couple of days of leave to be with them. So this week's episode is going to be a bit shorter than normal. And in fact, if you listen carefully, you can probably hear them in the background. Last week, I mentioned how much I enjoyed looking at some of the early Yes concert posters in David Watkinson's book from 2001, Yes Perpetual Change. It really is a fascinating collection of images, memorabilia, stories and listings from the history of the band. So this week I thought I'd pull out a few of the most interesting parts of the book. You may know the BBC television programme QI, which stands for Quite Interesting. It's a comedy spoof game show, which is hosted by the erudite and convivial Stephen Fry. This new series of podcast episodes are very, very loosely based on the concept of QI. I'm looking for aspects of the Yes Music story, which surprise me as I look through books and other sources, beginning with Perpetual Change this week. It's not going to be a game show format, but hopefully it will unearth a few aspects of the band that both you and I will find quite interesting. Of course, as usual, if you do spot any inaccuracies or can shine any further light on the areas covered, please do get in touch in the normal ways. The first section which attracts my attention is the Yes family tree. I always love these genealogies of rock bands. I'm sure you've seen some of the fascinating TV programmes based on these pieces of research. Looking from the vantage point of 2012, the fact that John Anderson's first recorded group was the Little John Skiffle Group seems wonderfully quaint. It was the late 1950s, and this was a group formed with some friends and John's brother Anthony. I don't know a lot about the Skiffle movement, but I understand it was the first time teenagers felt they could be involved in making pop music, so it's clear that Anderson was keen to be involved in popular music from the first moment he could. I wonder if he ever thought he would be playing to massive crowds in arenas around the world, rather than emulating Lonnie Donegan in his garage with his friends. Subsequently, Anderson had a lot of early experience in the reasonably successful band The Warriors, but more interesting is his brief reinvention under the somewhat bizarre pseudonym of Hans Christian Andersen, from April to June 1968. Two singles were released, the second having the wonderful title Autobiography of a Mississippi Hobo, but neither was a hit and the project was abandoned. David Watkinson's book includes a publicity photo of Hans Christian, in which Anderson is sporting a wonderfully frilly shirt. He looks very young indeed. This brief outing as a pop singer makes a very interesting parallel to the time Freddie Mercury spent with his chosen pseudonym of Larry Lurex, a reference to the discredited and now notorious Gary Glitter. Mercury released the pop single I Can Hear Music, which also featured fellow Queen musicians Brian May and Roger Taylor. The major difference in the two experiences is, of course, that Queen already existed as a band when Larry Lurex appeared, whereas Yes had not been formed by the time of Hans Christian Andersen. On the first page of the Yes family tree, Chris Squire's route to Yes is also very interesting. His subsequently reformed band The Sin features highly in three versions before Mabel Greer's Toy Shop appears, and that is of course where Squire and Anderson first teamed up with Peter Banks, Bill Bruford and Tony Kaye. In fact, the most interesting element of the timeline here is Mabel Greer's Toy Shop version 5, which features a lineup of Anderson, Squire, Banks, Kaye and Bruford. Sounds familiar? Of course. There's a huge amount of detail in this graphic representation of the comings and goings of personnel in the band, and most of it will be familiar to most fans, but there were some other aspects which caught my eye. The fact that Bill Bruford left the band in 1968 for 17 gigs, and was replaced firstly by Tony O'Reilly and then Ian Wallace, who only lasted for one concert, is interesting. The fact that Yes version 11 lasted for just 1 month in 1983, and featured the 90125 lineup, but with Eddie Jobson on keyboards rather than Tony Kaye. It puts a different slant on the progress of the band from drama to 90125, and the fact that even by 2001 there had been 18 different versions of Yes, including the ABWH venture, serves to point out the volatility of the special mix which has created the world's greatest progressive rock band. The next item which stands out to me is a full page from Melody Maker, presumably from 1974, which gives the result of their poll. Yes were voted best band in the world. What strikes me about it isn't that Yes won, it's the albums which are pictured at the bottom of the page. It seems really odd to think that this national magazine's readership was proclaiming Yes the greatest band in the world on the strength of just Yes, Time in a Word, the Yes album, Fragile, Close to the Edge, and Yes songs. That's just four studio albums. Looking back today, although it contains some of the most important Yes music of all, would I be doing this podcast every week if Yes had stopped at that point? I'm not sure I would. Without Tales from Topographic Oceans, Relayer, Going for the One, Tomato, and then all the Reformation works up to Fly from Here, perhaps Yes would actually have been consigned to a footnote in musical history. Maybe I would indeed be recording episodes about Queen, or Genesis, or King Crimson now. There's also an amusing little story about the launch of Tales. It suggests that perhaps the reaction wouldn't have been so severe if the wrong tapes had not been sent to the BBC in advance of the launch of the record. Yes fans and critics were supposed to have been given a preview of the material on the radio. However, without that shock, would the Yes story have been very different? Maybe it would. I was also amused to read about the Tomato tour, which featured Chris Squire's idea about playing in the round on a moving circular stage. The tour was a huge success, even if the album didn't receive the critical acclaim of previous works. However, one night the band noticed that about 20 people were missing from the front row. When Steve Howe played Clap, the rest of the band left the stage and were told that the machinery which moved the stage was broken and that the missing audience had been press-ganged into physically rotating the stage from underneath. This reminds me of the concert footage of Peter Gabriel's Growing Up Live tour, which was also in the round. The guitar technicians and stagehands were stationed beneath the stage, but I don't think they went as far as getting people from the audience to help out. I suppose worse things happen at sea. Hopefully not on the forthcoming Cruise to the Edge, though. A little later in the book is an advertisement for the Drama album. For those of us who thought that streaming a preview of albums over the internet was a new idea, here's proof that there really isn't anything new under the sun. As mentioned earlier, Tales was meant to have been previewed on the radio, and this Drama poster includes a phone number to ring to hear the album. Quite what the sound quality would have been like, I'm not sure, but it's a great idea, and one which all the sensible artists of today are copying on their websites. It reminds me of my earliest experiences of hearing records outside the home. The local library had listening stations, which were similar to phone booths. Each had a pair of headphones hooked up to a record player, and the public were free to choose any record in the library to listen to. I remember very vividly being fascinated by this concept, and being extremely frustrated that I was not allowed to have a go by my mother. I must have been less than 5 years old at the time, so it was around 1974. Just think, I could have been listening to the latest release, Relayer. A final quite interesting fact from the historical pages of the book is something else I managed to miss out on at the time. In 2000, visitors to yesworld.com were given the opportunity to create their own track selections on a CD of Yes live performances, complete with their choice of artwork. This was organised via imix.com, which doesn't seem to exist anymore. A great idea and very innovative for 12 years ago. The appendices to the book include tour dates, set lists and a collector's guide to all sorts of official and unofficial products, as well as memorabilia. Overall, I've only scratched the surface this week of what's contained in Perpetual Change. It's an essential purchase for all serious Yes fans, and an updated version is now well overdue. So, if you're listening, David Watkinson, how about a Volume 2 covering 2001 to 2013? I'm sure YMP listeners would be happy to contribute. So that's about it for this short episode this week. Just before I go, please remember, if you're listening to this episode in 2012 and you'd like to show your support for the show, please vote in the European Podcasts Award by visiting bit.ly/voteYMP, all one word. And I'll be back properly next week after half term. But in the meantime, please do get involved by subscribing to the podcast via RSS, iTunes, Stitcher.com, or the new Apple Podcasts app at yesmusicpodcast.com. where you can leave a comment on the blog. You can send a tweet or direct message to @YesMusicPodcast on Twitter. You can send an email to show@yesmusicpodcast.com. You can upload an audio file or record a voice message via the buttons on the site, or leave a voicemail on 0844-579-6949 using the mailbox number 39417. And there's also that new contact form on the website as well. So until next week, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.